AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Good to be with you today, Matt and Patrick. Today we've got Patrick Cooligan as well joining us from the Minnesota Reformer. Talk about some of the stories he's got going on today. Patrick, how are you today, my friend?
Good. It's been busy. What have you been up to today?
Well, fending off a few Kirk Cousins fans after yesterday's show. I'm once again not turning this into a sports talk show. I will say I kind of went after him a little bit. I think he's an okay guy. I do. I think he definitely was a much better player than he was last year. My criticism is it's 4th and 8. You threw the ball 3 yards. Now, once again, I think Patrick was pretty clear. I don't know who did that. Was that Cousins or was that the offensive coordinator? That was the set plan. But pretty much every other team, if it's 4th and 8, every receiver is 8 yards out or more, and that's where you make the decision. You don't throw it and then hope the other team misses tackles. I think I was pretty clear on that. I didn't know who was to blame. SB Nation. So I'm not dogging on the guy. I mean, he had a better year than he was supposed to. They still ended up not winning a home as the 3 seed, the home playoff game against a bad Giants team who will get beat by 40 at Philadelphia. They will just be they'll be embarrassed off the field. That being said, I did love the analysis by James Dater, who said who made this point. He goes, it's the Kirkland Cousins, which I've decided is now his name because he's a Costco brand franchise quarterback. I know that sounds like slander, but it's not really. I have great admiration for Costco items. They're absolutely functional facsimiles of high-end products. They will get the basic job done for you, but nobody is ever going to be spreading the word about the Kirkland charcuterie platter you brought at the Box Social. Cousins will forever be the guy he is right now. I thought that was a very standard thing. Is that a very great way to say it? Yeah, he's serviceable. And he can get the ball downfield, and he can make some good plays every once in a while. But, he's not a mobile quarterback. And he's not a quarterback that's so reliable like Aaron Rodgers, who's not mobile. I mean, he has been mobile at times, but Brady, Aaron Rodgers, they're not exactly known for their running ability, but what they're known for is their unbelievable manner to get a ball into a specific spot, and Cousins is not that guy. So I'm not saying you give up on Kirk Cousins because I think that, the defense had a lot to do with that loss, but I had a few Cousins fans come after me, and I'm like, I'm just going to nip this in the bud really quick. The other thing I wanted to make sure I mention is something that is, after we talked about the MLK Day, something that was brought to my attention and I think is an incredibly fair point. Now, here's the truth is, you cannot, in my mind, argue that you are praising MLK. One of the ones that got thrown to me was Youngkin, the governor of Virginia. It was an honor to participate in the 45th annual Dr. Martin Luther King Community Leader Celebration. He's actually, and someone pointed out here, Glenn Youkin is actively working against everything Dr. King stood for. He has crusaded to the CRT panic and pushed to remove Black history from the Virginia curriculum. Tomorrow, he'll go back to fighting against equality. John Author made the point, amongst many others. I hope that conservative posting of inspirational MLK quotes recognizes that if Dr. King was in school teacher today, those same words would be used as proof he's teaching CRT, which is exactly right. You can't claim to be praising MLK. Don't do it. If you are out there talking about critical race theory, because critical race theory, we played yesterday the exceptional Other America speech. I mean, 15 minutes of it, it's a long speech. But if you heard the 15 minutes of it we played, Martin Luther King Jr. was not mixing words there. The Other America was the America that is not being represented. It is, systemic segregation, systemic racism, systemic flaws that basically prevented them from being able to get an advantage. It was very clear in most schools under the current CRT language, they couldn't play 99% of Martin Luther King's speeches. They couldn't. As a matter of fact, I'm reminded of a very good article that was put out by MSNBC? MSNBC was last year. And basically, it was summer of 2 years ago, in 2021. It echoes Dr. King's wish that we should judge people on the content of the character, not the color of the skin. And they always throw that one quote out from King to basically argue for their things. The talking point is apparently the new Republican orthodoxy. In a campaign rally last year, then President Trump claimed that critical race theory is Marxist doctrine that rejects the vision of Martin Luther King. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis likewise asserted the critical race theory was basically teaching kids that they hate our country and to hate each other based on race, adding it puts race as the most important thing. I want content of character to be the most important thing. In making such comments, Republican officials reveal they don't really understand critical race theory, and they really don't understand Martin Luther King Jr. either. Despite the moral panic from conservative Republicans that has been designed with kids in mind, critical race theory has largely been limited to law schools and advanced graduate programs. Moreover, far from the stressing the race is the most important thing, critical race theory challenges the idea that race is a thing at all. It starts with the premise that there is no biological or scientific justification for racial categories and that race was socially constructed invention and a fiction that nevertheless has been written into our laws and legislations. Those who work on critical race theory are baffled by the seemingly deliberate mischaracterizations of their work. Contrary to Republican cries of this scholarship is un-American, the Crenshaw asserts that critical race theory is not anti-patriotic on that. But then it goes on further, they argue, talking honestly about inequity, it turns out, was a special point of emphasis for Martin Luther King Jr. He devoted a considerable amount of his activism and authorship doing it. But the limited knowledge that Trump, DeSantis, and Toth all have King's work apparently begins and ends with that one line about character. To appreciate this reality and to see how wrong those who see MLK and critical race theory as diametrically opposed, look no further than two iconic moments. The Texas law encourages teachers to use Martin Luther King Jr. letter to the Birmingham jail and I Have a Dream speech in his landmark address. And by the way, letter from a Birmingham jail and I Have a Dream speech. If you didn't know the author of those, you would ban those from school under critical race theory. In his landmark address to the Washington March on Washington in August 1963, King did note that his hope that one day his children will be judged by the character, not by the color of skin, but that was only one line for a more nuanced address. More important, while King looked ahead to that day, his vision remained firmly fixed on the realities of racism and discrimination of his own time, and he devoted the bulk of his address to identifying and articulating them. But once again, Republicans specifically don't want to hear this. And like I said, I think the important thing is to look back on the speech we aired yesterday, The Two Americas, which was in 1967 at Stanford University. And it's just a stark reminder that he was very much trying to get people to look at what was going on the other side of the tracks, to see the systemic racism in the system. And once again, it did help yesterday to go to the Science Museum of Minnesota over in St. Paul and go see the bias exhibit they have, because nothing, I think, would be better for most people than to go out there and realize the bias that exists within the system. And that we are so comfortable with bias. And by the way, and one of the arguments the exhibit makes is bias is inevitable. It just is something that's inevitable. We all have bias, but we can't fix the bias that we have that infringes on other people's rights unless we acknowledge what it is. It's like they have this one scene where the kid is fidgeting. It's an African-American kid who's in class and he's fidgeting. And of course, he's in trouble again because he couldn't sit still. Meanwhile, how many times would you have it where there is a white kid who is doing the same exact thing, is doing the same exact fidgeting, and well, he's just rambunctious. He's a character. Oh boy, he's at it again, and that's the bias in the system. You know, sometimes it's very blatant, like covenants, racial covenants, and I got to get a Coleman Gaither on because she was talking about this, and this is the Jim Crow of the North. This whole thing that PBS is doing, I got to get her on because I mean, sometimes it's very blatant. It's like black people can't live in this house. We're going to prevent black people from ever being able to buy this house. That attempt in the 1930s, 1940s, until the Supreme Court stepped in and said, well, you can't do that. What you get, though, is this unknown bias. Now, Republicans, in my mind, participate in known bias all the time. Their entire concept of against critical race theory is far more to do with stopping people from seeing the inequity that is still there today, still in existence today. That they don't want you to see it. They don't want that to be recognized. They just that everyone's there. And because their argument is the system isn't broken, it's just they're a bunch of lazy people. And henceforth, I, who was born with a silver spoon in my mouth and living in the wealthy white suburbs, I had to work just as hard as the kid from the inner city, and I made it. And henceforth, if I didn't make it, well then, and if there is an unfairness, I have to acknowledge that I got there unfairly. Well, you probably should. You know, frankly, you know, you had a system. I mean, one of the things I talked about yesterday in regards to redlining and racial covenants, it wasn't just about stopping minorities from being there. It was about preserving wealth for white people. That white people were the only ones to get wealthy. They were the only ones to be able to become homeowners, use that home as leverage to get other credit, give themselves an advantage, pay for college. Of course they did. So this whole concept of critical race theory, it's not about basically trying to make things equal. It's trying to whitewash the past once again. And I'll put out there again that the speeches of all these Republicans who praised Martin Luther King yesterday, that past trying to encourage critical race theory, their entire argument is basically critical race theory cannot exist or it has to exist to stop the message of Martin Luther King. But it's also, it goes beyond that. In when you go out there and you try to basically whittle down Martin Luther King down to one line, and that's the only line you should know, and basically use that line for Martin Luther King to say, hey, black kids, shut up. He says we're not supposed to see race, so I'm not going to see your problems. That's intentional, too. You know, I think that the sometimes you don't realize the impact of what you do have. Like I said, I think that this exhibit yesterday was exceptional because not only did we have a case where you learned the fact that bias exists and it's there, but the extent of that it is still there and that you can't solve these problems unless you're willing to go out there on a ledge and really try to solve them. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let me get into right now another story that's out there, and I'll at least start talking about this. And I'm going to start by reminding Republicans, a few years ago, when Black Lives Matter tried to march at the Mall of America, you guys came out there and were like, you can't do that. That's private property. You can't do that. Get them out of there. Remember that? I remember that. Oh, you hypocrites. Anyway, there is a new incident at the Mall of America, which has got the conservatives' undies in a bunch. How about we say it like that? Oh, how dare you? The Mall America is trending on social media platforms. This is from Bring Me the News. Is trending on social media platforms following an incident involving a man in a Jesus Saves t-shirt. Now, not exactly Jesus Saves. I'll get to that t-shirt here in a sec, in a secchi-poo. The man identified as Paul Shoro has been seen on video interacting with a security guard on January 7th after complaints were made that the man's shirt, the back of the shirt says, "Jesus is the only way," with the word "coexist" crossed out in reference to other religions and spiritual beliefs. So basically, he's wearing a shirt that says all the rest of the religions, Judaism, Muslim, Buddhist, atheist, all of them don't matter. That which is a shirt of hate. I mean, can you imagine what it would be like if a Republican was wearing, walked past a man in a shirt that said "Islam is the only way" and an X crossed off on a cross? They would be livid. So this guy is walking around with a shirt of hate. Let's just cut the crud. He's trying to drape himself in Jesus, but I can tell you right now, Jesus ain't on his side. Jesus ain't not on his side. Not on this one. Not the peace, loving, welcoming, caring, compassion. Yeah, Jesus wasn't out there basically talking about we need to hate everybody else. That was just not it. So he's wearing a shirt of hate. And understandably, some people were a little bothered by that, and I can understand that. The Mall of Miracle told Bring Me the News the man had received a 24-hour trespass ban for soliciting a week earlier. Solicitation is not allowed on the private property, according to MOA's conduct policy. Sweet Jesus, thank God for that. Can you imagine what it would be like walking through the Mall of America if, you know, you got, it was like Vegas and they were handing out, you know, flyers everywhere. Holy God. Ugh. I'm okay with that one. The video shows a security guard talking to Shoro saying people have been offended by the man's shirt and all he asked him to do is take the shirt off and all you can stay. So once again, I want to make sure people understand this. The people are not upset with the Jesus saves part of his shirt or Jesus is the only way, really. They're upset that he is basically dismissing all other religions in his attempt to show he's, you know, a super Christian, I guess. You can't solicit religion on private property, the guard says to Shoro multiple times in reference to Shoro's claim he was only preaching the conduct gospel. And by the way, there's courtesy of the Mall of America, their conduct policy. Loitering, engaging, or soliciting, blocking storefronts, hallways, skyways, fire exits, escalators, or walking groups such as the way is in such a way as to inconvenience others. Also, picketing, demonstrating, soliciting, protesting, and petitioning. And protesting, and I make an argument, even though they didn't highlight protesting, I'd make an argument that indeed protesting was exactly what he was doing. He was protesting other religions. In an email, the spokesperson with MOA told Bring Me the Moon, well, man wasn't required to change his shirt, was allowed to stay in the mall following the interaction. The guest referenced in the video was approached by Mall of America security on January 7th, 1 week prior. He would issue a 24-hour trespass for soliciting guests. After a brief interaction, the guest was not required to change his shirt, was allowed to remain in the mall. So here is a guy who's already broken the rules at the Mall of America. He is there now with a shirt that's upsetting their people. He was still allowed to stay. There's no problem. Cue the "We're the real victims, Whitey America" from the far right. Can we just, on all your epitaphs, hey, why don't all you could, "We were the real victims." Oh, so, hey, the calm, cool, and collected far-right news media has picked up this video and, of course, is ignoring a lot of it. The video has been picked up by a number of conservative right-wing media outlets, as well as being shared wildly with some posts and articles, leaving out the important context, such as the man's ban on soliciting, the previous 24-hour ban he received. The Daily Mail mentions the trespass and solicitation elements, but its headline states, "Shoro was kicked out of the mall," which the mall claimed was not true. Okay, here's where it gets hilarious. A change petition has been created titled "Stop Religious Discrimination at the Mall of America." It has received thousands of signatures as of today, even though the man's shirt is basically a textbook definition of religious discrimination as it crossed out religious symbols of Islam, Judaism, paganism, Chinese philosophy, and even Christianity under the phrase coexist. Charo said in an interview with you. So he's basically saying I'm being discriminated against because I can't walk into the Mall America and wear a shirt that says everyone else is wrong, I am right. Wow. That is a level of arrogance you basically only find with a conservative. Let's remind everyone, how many conservative politicians have tried to claim credit for bills they intentionally voted against? Just so they could, yeah, a lot of them, yep. Charles said in an interview with a YouTuber that he was handed out religious pamphlets in the mail before the incident and goes there every day. He said on Christmas Eve, mall security suspended him for 24 hours for preaching on the premises. So, wait a second here. Now you have a guy who belligerently is violating the rules of the Mall of America. And by the way, once again, all these people who are frustrated and angry about this, 100% on banning Black Lives Matter at the Mall of America. 100% that they can't rally there, but now are, how dare the Mall of America violate the public square? Yes. Feigned exaggeration is the key. He basically twice he was thrown on the Mall of America, and now he's wearing a shirt of hate. Okie doke. A Minnesota right-wing group on Facebook is planning a protest in response to February 4th. The group will meet from 1 to 4 inside the mall in front of the L.L. Bean, according... Wow, that's, if you're going to go for a white store, sweet lord. is there a MyPillow store in there? No, probably not. It'd be called Dominion Pillow here before too long, I'm going to guess. According to the post, the mall has previously seen Black Lives Matter protests on a protester property, which Mall of America has stated previously the protests were unauthorized and those involved could be subject to arrest. Well, if this group is going to show up on February 4th at 1 to 4 in front of the L.L. Bean, well, maybe, just maybe, other groups should show up to protest on February 4th from 1 to 4 in front of the L.L. Bean. If we're going to allow some protest, why not allow bring in some of these other groups that I'm sure the defenders of the guy wearing the hate shirt would love to be able to protest next to. Love to be able to protest next to. Yeah. (952) 946-6205. All right, I got a technical thing here. I'm going to throw it to break here. We'll come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Beautiful. Yeah, here it is. I'm looking at it. Babe the Blue Ox is wearing a bill that says I Heart Meat. Well, who doesn't? 952-946-6205. It was in a straight-to-DVD video I was in at one point. Hey, I had to make some money in college. 952-946-6205. You know what? Maybe I should just... We're having a little technical problems at the station. I don't mind sharing more radio stories with you because, I mean, this is... I can get back to the topics here. We got hopefully Cooligan going to be joining us here in the next hour and stuff like this. I can get back to the stuff I was going to talk about. Let me share another one with you, because I've always loved this story, because it goes back to my very early days in radio, where I was hatched at a radio station in Nuremberg, Germany. I was in the military, and one day I came home, and the TV service that was on the air was a thing called AFRTS, Armed Forces Radio and Television Service. And we're sitting there, and I was at that time trained as what's called a 31 Charlie, a rat rig operator, a radio and teletype rig. We went with headquarters companies and we dictated stuff to them. And we got on there. I was watching AFRTS and the news, and they said, "Hey, guess what? All 31 Charlies, you got to pack up all your gear because it's been sold to the Spanish and the Greeks." And the first thing I said to myself is, "Well, if we want some, you know, armies to beat up on, the Spanish and the Greeks are number one and two on that list." But because this was old, antiquated equipment. And this was pre-satellite days. And as a matter of fact, that was kind of the next thing, is they wanted everyone to go back to satellite school. I didn't want to do another 4 years in the military at that point. So I was unemployed while being in the military. And it was kind of an interesting thing. And I had a security clearance, so I went and worked for one office, and I went and worked for another office. Eventually, they had me on cinder block moving detail in the motor pool. Delightful. And then one day, I'm sitting there drowning my sorrows in a place called Finnegan's Harp in downtown Nuremberg, an Irish bar over there. And this guy named Russ Turpening was there, and he's I'd known Russ. He was one of those guys that hangs around in the bar, and you're there, and he's drinking, and I just said, yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do. And he said, well, you got a good enough voice. Have you ever thought about doing AFN, Armed Forces Network? I said, no. So I went over, and they were so desperate for people at AFN. I have never seen a personnel switch that fast. And I became a radio broadcaster with some of the most uptight radio people I've ever worked with in my life. Sweet Lord, CBS Radio. Anyway, no, they were very military people. I'm like, come on, guys, you gotta let it loose, man. Let it loose. They were okay. They were good people. And they were very tolerant of me. And they trained me basically on how to do things. And I did the best I could. While I was there, there's a song from a band called Nirvana that sounds like Teen Spirit, smells like Teen Spirit. And it was the sound of it was a much harder sound. Now, little thing back then, Armed Forces Network could not basically not play a top hit. It had to play a top hit. And so we all had to listen to these songs on. They sent out these discs with all the singles being released. And I said, you know, that one from Nirvana seems like it's going to be a pretty good song. And they said, no, we don't want you to play that. I said, why not? I said, well, because it's just too hard. We don't play heavy metal stuff. Okay. So all of a sudden, the song hit the top 40. I said, you should be playing this. It's a top 40 song. And they said, no, don't play it. I'm like, really? Then it was top 20. And I said, we got to play this. This is a hit. Finally, they relented. And I said, on a Saturday, I was doing a Saturday show. And he said, you know, I'll let you play it once. I played it. Let it go. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, loud, obnoxious. Germans loved it. Holy cow. And apparently I have got credit for being the first guy to ever play Nirvana in Germany anywhere. Armed Forces Network in the German market, because I had all these, was ist das? Sehr gut, was ist das? Nirvana, smells like Teen Spirit. Sehr gut. It was an experience. I mean, I only had like 25 million listeners because it was Germany. I mean, it's like all these people that were listening in. I'll never have a larger audience than I did in my first radio gig, which was Armed Forces Radio Network. And I just had this huge audience, and I'm playing this, and I played the song. Ended up, very quickly, everyone was playing, and I had a few of the uptight guys like, why did you have to play that song? Now everyone wants to hear it all the time. It's like, heaven forbid we actually play the hits, huh? There you go. I don't think we have Nirvana. It smells like Teen Spirit. It's so quaint now. It's such a quaint little song today. Back then, I was such a rebel. Such a rebel. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. We are back, hopefully, a regular hour coming up next hour. Make sure you stay with us. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Hour number two of the show. Matt, Patrick there. Patrick, are you guys all okay? We didn't electrocute Brett again, did we?
Only a couple times, man.
Only a couple of times. Well, that's fine. That's fine. How much duct tape did we use this time?
I don't know. I think we might have bought out the entire Menards down the road from us.
Oh, man. You know, you can get it in bulk and it there. So you guys doing okay? How much weight did you guys lose during that hour? Because I'm fine. You can just put a quarter in me and let me go. I'm fine. You guys doing okay there, though? We're up and running. We're good. We're set.
Yeah, we had a nasty power surge that knocked out a few things in the transmitter room. And one of them was kind of something that we were a little surprised about. That kind of took us a little bit to figure out what actually was one of the
that
issues.
Was my that's my cappuccino maker. I put that back. My bad. I should have let you guys know about that. That's on me.
Well, why didn't you let us know? I would have made myself a cup during the crisis.
Try the caramel. It's delicious. It really is just it is a delightful thing. But nicely done, guys. I mean, you were able to get things back up and running, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how we get to listen to this crap. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it's seriously. I mean, is anyone? I don't think that's the when I'm looking to get into Pavic. I don't think I'm putting Last Hour up there. It's like, hey, here's my Hall of Fame material. Hey,
it's not going on my resume for my next application either. Oh, Patrick kind of wanders around the transmitter room pushing buttons and nothing happens.
Oh, but it's always a delight. Radio, welcome to radio, folks. And like I said, this isn't even close to the worst experience I've ever had with a radio station, you know, dying on me. 952-946-6205. By the way, Patrick, have you seen the absolutely adorable story from CBS News? I think it was CBS This Morning this weekend. Did it about the Glenlake Elementary in the Hopkins School District. They raised $300,000 to build an adaptive playground that's going to be inclusive for students with physical disabilities. Did you see that story perchance at all?
I did. That was tough to I was kind of smelling some onions after that.
Well,
one.
That was the kid breaking down during the thing where he was just talking about how happy he was he could do something. Oh, it was very nice. I do want to make one quick correction, though. Just there's a lot of places that are saying this is in Hopkins. Now, Glen Lake's actually in Minnetonka. A good chunk of basically Hopkins School District is eastern Minnetonka and the city of Hopkins, plus a little Eden Prairie, plus a little of Edina, plus a little of Golden Valley. It's a pretty expansive district. There's a lot of places that are saying Glen Lake Elementary is in Hopkins. Actually, it's in Minnetonka. I did want to just clarify that. But you can't deny the absolutely wonderful gesture that they did and how they never let that get in the way, that the cost was not going to ever get in the way, and they did this. And as a matter of fact, can I make an argument that that's a, you know, maybe we should be doing this at the other schools too. I get it. It is pricey. I get it. But, you know, maybe not the worst idea to do in the other schools. 952-946-6205. I want to say, because, you know, if anyone knows, I'm in love with Gully Boys. I think they're a fantastic band. Local band makes good. Racket is announcing the Green Room. This is the new Uptown music venue taking shape in the old poorhouse space. We know who will play the 400-capacity concert hall's premiere evening, January 28th. Gully Boys and Scrunchies are going to be there, both of them have been the recipients of glowing reviews from Racket. There's also going to be Fenix Dian, Denim Matriarch, and Colin Bracewell will also rock the first-ever Green Room show. Minneapolis singer-songwriter Preston Gunderson scheduled for February 4th. People are living in Uptown, and for whatever reason, they aren't going out. Maybe they don't feel safe. Maybe they aren't enough options. I personally think it's the latter. Green Room manager Tanner Montague told us, I'm down for the challenge. Absolutely fantastic. I mean, the music scene in this town is pretty good. So that's a heck of a lineup, by the way. Gully Boys, Scrunchies, Fenix Dian, Denim Matriarch, and Colin Bracewell. A heck of a lineup you have. That's January 28th. At the Green Room, I might have to go to. I've got a brace on. I've got a broken back, and I might go down to see that show. It would be worthwhile, and I'm convenient for carrying. I mean, I'm like a, you know, you can pick me up like a six pack. It's nice. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. By the way, one thing I wanted to mention here. There was one story I was going to get to about Minnesota legislative stuff. Last hour before I got into Matt's roaming down Memorial Way and Babe the Blue Ox wearing a bib that says I Heart Meat. But that has to do with Governor Walz. He has put forward his proposal, what he would like to see in regards to education. The DFL governor aims to increase education spending by $2.2 billion over the next 4 years and create a new state agency centered on children, youth, and families. He revealed a $5.2 billion piece of his two-year budget Tuesday ahead of the full announcement next week. For a middle-class family with young kids, this budget would cut the cost of childcare by thousands Wall said in a statement. For kids across the state, it will reduce the chances of living in poverty. And for our students, it will provide the single largest infusion of state funding in history, allowing them to provide every student in every neighborhood a world-class education. Walls must negotiate with the leaders of the Democratic-controlled House and Senate, though, to reach the final spending plan over the next 2 years. You got a lot of people in the House and the Senate who are big on education. I have a feeling it's got a decent chance. Maybe not in these exact numbers, but there'll be some – that's negotiations. Walls says he proposes expanding the child's state child's and dependent tax care tax credit. So the child and dependent care tax credit, which his administration said would help about 100,000 households with child care costs. Families that earn less than $200,000 could get up to $4,000 if they have one child, $8,000 for two children, $10,500 if they have three kids. He's also pushing for a child tax credit for lower-income Minnesotans, which would give families $1,000 per child up to $3,000. And let's face it, I mean, when we talk about – how many times did I do Democrat of the Day this last year when I talked to Democratic politicians who were talking about no one is out in rural Minnesota talking about the need for more affordable daycare options out there? If you've got two kids, say – you get $8,000 for two children on a tax credit there, $2,000 more per child. There you're going to get $10,000. That's going to go a long way to make that daycare a lot more affordable. Absolutely. The agency Walls proposed, called the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, would take over some work currently handled by other agencies, including early learning programs, child support, and food assistance. The idea harkens back to the 1995 creation of the Children, Families, and Learning Department under Republican Governor Arne Carlson, who merged with the work of various agencies with a similar goal of addressing the needs of the most entitled child. 8 years later, Governor Plenty renamed it the Department of Education, and what he described at the time as an effort to get back to the core mission of educating children. Reminder, Tim Pawlenty killed the Minnesota miracle. He did. He did. Republicans and Tim Pawlenty did that. Walls is aiming to reduce how much school districts are paying for special education by 50%. And he wants to spend hundreds of millions to provide free meals to all students. He also proposed $158 million more for youth and student mental health needs. That's a great start. I think it's woefully inadequate because I think, I think you need to get a counselor in every single school, junior high, high school, elementary, junior high, and high school in the state. I honestly do. That is something which we've talked about mental health needs. I've had experts on to talk about this. That is absolutely, I think, the minimum, having a mental health expert in every elementary school, junior high school, and senior high school in the state. Democrats who control the House and Senate have also set education and supporting families to top priorities. Some of the first bills they introduced include free student breakfasts and lunch, child tax care credits, and paid family medical leave. It makes me wonder if Walls is what he's trying to do is, say, whoa, 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 Democrats, hold up there a little bit. I get it. You got a lot of bills you're going to put out here, but let's make sure that we're, working together as opposed to, passing bills and then hurting the whole system. So I'm wondering if the administration's rushing to get this out is kind of in response to the, particularly the House Democrats, kind of getting out with already on day one. Walls is a former high school social studies teacher, and we think a lot alike, said retired teacher Mary Kunish, the DFL from New Brighton, friend of Native Roots Radio, I'm Awake, in the 6 o'clock hour. And at Tuesday's news conference with legislators, many of them former educators, Kunish is pushing to spend around $500 million in a one-time cash this school year to help with special education, school meals, bus services, and English language learning expenses. All those aspects are one of the priorities of the governor as well. She said, how we sort it out at the end of the day will be determined, but I would like to see this done and done quickly. Because, considering the Democrats control everything, we won't have to wait for the monstrosity bills, the Frankenstein bills at the end of the session. They actually might be able to get this stuff passed in a regular function. In addition to the fast cash infusion, legislators are also developing their own education funding plans for the next 2 years. They have not yet presented the full financial picture, but stressed they want to close the ongoing gaps between the cost of providing special education and English language. State leaders expect to have a record-breaking $17.6 billion budget surplus to help them achieve their goals although they've often noted the risk in using one-time money to set up programs that will require continuous spending. Budget officers will update the surplus estimate in February. That's why I think what Walz is suggesting is actually pretty smart, because what he's actually saying is, hey, guess what? We can do this and actually fold some of the pre-existing programs into it, so there's already funding there for some of this stuff in place. You're going to have to fund, I agree wholeheartedly, you're going to have to make daycare, childcare more affordable. You got to get psychologists, you got to get mental health experts into these school districts. So that's money you're going to have to spend, and you're going to have to find a way to fund that in the future, because those are going to be needs which are not going to go away. 952-946-6205. Patrick, do we still have Patrick Cooligan here?
Yes, we do.
Indeed. All right. Patrick Cooligan is kind enough to join us. If you've not, of course, known him, if you've not heard him on the show, Patrick Cooligan, of course, a fantastic presence over at the Minnesota Reformer, talking about well water pollution and a bit of the commentary on medical practices. I actually talked about that a little bit as well last Friday. It's good stuff here from the Minnesota Reformer. If you're not reading it, you're wrong. It's a fantastic news outlet. It's Brett with Patrick Cooligan right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. And as usual on Tuesdays, we're joined by Patrick Cooligan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Latest in Minnesota news and politics, make sure you go to MinnesotaReformer.com. As today we are going to be taking a little bit of a theme of the big guy, or of big business versus the little guy, as we're going to be talking about a couple of pieces in the Minnesota Reformer, one that has to do with the demise of small medical practices and another on unsafe well drinking water in rural Minnesota. Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Good to be here.
Absolutely. So let's start off talking about these small medical practices, because Elizabeth Slattery is a local doctor who recently wrote a commentary in the Minnesota Reformer titled, "Where Have All the Small Medical Practices Gone?" So this is an interesting story, Patrick, because little is known about kind of the idea of how these small practices have really been taken over by much larger practices over the past few years or so, as Dr. Slattery talks about why she closed her practice even though she loved doing it. But really, there were a lot of unintended consequences from the Affordable Care Act, among other things, which Dr. Slattery admits was an overall good thing, but didn't do so much when it comes to helping small medical practices. And it sounds like, Patrick, this is not just the case in Minnesota, but the entire Midwest, where a lot of these small practices have been hurt by these much larger medical facilities and medical organizations, thanks to some kind of unintended consequences of the ACA and other factors, correct?
Yeah, so the Affordable Care Act did a bunch of things, including it allowed people to get insurance even if they had a pre-existing condition, and it allowed, it created these marketplaces where people can get discounted health insurance, and it was actually good health insurance and not junk health insurance. It also expanded Medicaid, so more people were able to get some kind of basic health care at all. But it also, there were some other provisions that were really part of what amounted to the reordering of the American healthcare industry, and one of those was the creation of these accountable care organizations that and the federal government relaxed some rules that allowed doctors to or these ACOs to allow inside only referrals, so that it created this kind of a large vertically integrated healthcare organization where you would get all your care from this one outfit. And the idea was that it was integrated care, that your heart doctor ought to know what your diabetes diagnosis is, and we could save money if care was integrated and we could get better quality. And so they relaxed these rules and allowed allowed clinics to get larger and these hospital companies to consolidate. And it did indeed set off a wave of consolidation. And is really at the expense of the small practitioner. Many of them were really forced out of business, and Dr. Slattery, who, as it happens, is my former doctor before she retired, she was one of them. It was just it was impossible for her to compete. And I think she speaks for a lot of other small practitioners who were put out of business. And certainly we are we're testing the hypothesis that bigger is better in medicine. Obviously, Dr. Slattery doesn't think so.
Yeah, and I can understand why she and other small practices would have such trouble when you have these large ACOs where if you're essentially not part of their network and you need a referral, well, you're kind of out of luck if you're with one of these small providers simply because, well, they aren't part of these networks and you're kind of out of luck if you're not. And she also brought up the fact that bigger is not necessarily better healthcare as well. So it's tough for patients if you normally would want to see your family physician, someone that, you know, is locally owned that you can talk to rather than these big ACOs. But if they essentially don't have the ability to compete, it's a tough situation. And then it just compounds the fact that, well, generally healthcare has not gotten better as healthcare organizations have gotten bigger. So yeah, it's certainly a tough situation for a lot of these small medical practices. And I'm glad you guys ran this commentary because it's something we don't often hear about when we talk about the healthcare debate. We usually talk about kind of these big macro issues and we kind of forget that, well, we still need to make sure we're supporting our local medical practices as well. And they've really been getting hit hard the past few years.
Yeah. I mean, the first time I went to see Dr. Slattery, she essentially interviewed me about my health for, I would say, 45 minutes. And this is just what she does where when she was practicing. She's now retired. I think that early conversation led to really improved my health markedly because then she was able to figure out, well, you know, where are you health, what areas do you need help in? And when you go to one of these big providers, that would be almost unheard of because you meet with a doctor and they look at, I'm sure they're looking at like 10, 15 minute increments and it's just all dollars. And every minute you go over 15 is a minute you could spend on a different patient for more money. And so it's just the whole practice of medicine, the way that she practices medicine is, I fear, has been, is now really at risk, and so it's not just the fact that we're losing all these small practices. It's also that we're losing an entire way of doing medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. And once they go away, they're probably not coming back. I know she didn't necessarily write about this in the commentary, but does she have any thoughts on how we can improve our healthcare system for small medical practices? Did she have any thoughts on how we can change things, or is this kind of the train out of the tunnel, and we're kind of at a too late situation?
Well, I think stay tuned. Dr. Slattery, she's written now two pieces for us. I think she's going to write more about our healthcare system and how we can improve it.
Absolutely. So we'll have to make sure we follow along with that. Make sure you go to MinnesotaReformer.com, MinnesotaReformer.com. It was a commentary from last week, but do encourage you to check it out because it's an aspect of our healthcare debate that often gets overlooked, those very small medical practices. I want to move on to another piece that has to do with safe, well drinking water in rural Minnesota, because this is something I had no idea about, Patrick, that in Minnesota, more than 1.2 million people drink their water out of well. And I guess I should have thought of that because here at our radio station, we actually do have well water ourselves, although we typically don't use it for drinking. But what's a big deal about this well water in rural Minnesota is that, well, sometimes you can get groundwater systems that, well, get runoff from different chemicals that are put into, well, different farms, and that can lead to nitrates in the drinking water. And once those seep into the drinking water, they can make it unsafe and even lead to conditions such as blue baby syndrome, which is a potentially life-threatening condition affecting the blood's ability to carry oxygen throughout the level. So you would think this would be a major issue at the state legislature, possibly even the federal level, to try to figure out how we can clean up some of our well water. So what I found really surprising about this, Patrick, is that when nitrates do reach the underground drinking water supply at an unsafe level, whose responsibility is this to clean up? Because I was surprised about this as I was reading through this article today.
So the problem is that well owners are stuck with the bill to do any kind of mitigation here. The writer, Madison McMahon, talked to a couple landowners who are trying to organize property owners who are stuck in this situation. I think it's this piece speaks to the degree to which agriculture is just simply not regulated in the same way that many other industries are. And that goes to the really significant influence of agriculture at the legislature and in Congress. It tends to be something that gets bipartisan support. You know, I mean, it's hard for people to be against farmers. I mean, it's kind of like veterans. They avoid the kind of regulatory scrutiny in many cases that are applied to other industries. And this is affecting the water quality in many parts of rural Minnesota because of the fertilizer and manure that is going into the water.
Well, it sounds like, too, when we look at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and let's say you're someone who does run into this issue where you do have too much nitrates in your water, at least to me it sounds like the emphasis with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is more on, well, fixing the symptoms and not necessarily the cause. And what I mean by that is that, well, they put a major emphasis on testing, but not necessarily resolving the issue, which, yeah, great that you know that your water has too many nitrates in it, but you're kind of on your own when it comes to actually, well, solving the issue, which can be very, very expensive with homeowners, I'm sure, that are experiencing this issue.
Right, and as you mentioned, dealing with the symptoms as opposed to the underlying cause here, which is the way we do agriculture, and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, like departments of agriculture all across the country, and I suspect the U.S. Department of Agriculure, they're I think they tend to see farmers as their constituents, and a critic of these regulators would say that they're a captured regulatory agency that is not considering more fundamental shifts in how we do agriculture and therefore how we preserve water quality.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other stat I wanted to point out was that apparently only 20% of well owners even regularly test their water. So it's certainly a big situation that we got to get a hold on. And maybe something will happen at the state legislature, but I'm a little skeptical that it will, just simply because of the power of Big Ag. Is there any word of something happening at the state legislature? I know the lobbying group is largely against the idea of adding new regulations. Have you been hearing anything that might be happening at the legislature this session?
A lot going on at the legislature this year with the new DFL trifecta. I've not heard anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Rick Hansen is certainly aware of it and is a pretty solid environmental advocate. If anything at all, it'll come from him, but so we'll just have to wait and see. But it's certainly not something that they've been widely promoting thus far, although it's early in the session.
Well, you can follow more along with this issue over at MinnesotaReformer.com, MinnesotaReformer.com. Make sure you check out the piece on Dr. Slattery's commentary about kind of the demise of small medical practices, and then also check out this issue on rural drinking water from wells. It's a major issue that I wasn't really aware of all that much, but when you consider you have 1.2 million people that are drinking well water, not good if they're getting nitrates within that drinking water. So make sure you check out both of those, kind of like the theme as we're talking about how average Minnesotans trying to, well, get through against interests of a big business. So make sure you check those out, MinnesotaReformer.com. Patrick, as always, thanks for coming on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, just once again, I was noticing a few people up on the social media feed. We broadcast the show, although I'm not in studio. We still broadcast the show live on most social media apps. Apparently, it went down during those apps because we had a power surge. So if you were listening to us on, say, like the one of the internet feeds, that went down. So, but still here, not shocked yet, keeping a trepid eye on the sky, but no. We are back. So thanks for being with us. I do appreciate it. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Solomon Pena. Police have said they arrested the suspected mastermind behind some of the recent shootings at homes and offices of Democratic officials in New Mexico. The attacks come amid growing number of threats and attacks targeting political figures and elected officials. Local and federal authorities in New Mexico have been investigating since last month multiple separate shootings targeting Democratic officials' homes and offices. No one was injured in the attacks, but three homes were indeed damaged. Albuquerque police said Monday they arrested Solomon Pena, a Republican candidate who lost two previous House elections in connection with some of the shootings. It's believed that Pena is the mastermind behind this. Medina said, this is the police officer Medina, said that in a news conference on Monday. Pena's arrest comes after another suspect was arrested in connection with the six shootings. Police say Pena was not involved or connected with at least two of the reported shootings, though, per the New York Times. Pena has been accused of conspiring with or paying four men to shoot at the homes of two county commissioners and two state legislatures, said the Albuquerque Police Department Chief Harold Medina. Pena allegedly paid cash to four men to conduct at least two drive-by shootings, Deputy Police Commander Kyle Hartsock said to the Associated Press. Pena joined the men during the attack in New Mexico against State Senator Linda Lopez's home and allegedly attempted to shoot with a weapon that malfunctioned, police said, per the New York Times. This type of radicalism is a threat to our nation and has made its way to the doorstep right here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Albuquerque Mayor Tim Keller said, per the Associated Press. But I know we're going to push back. We will not allow this to cross this threshold. Republican Party of New Mexico, in a less than bold statement, said that Pena faces serious allegations. He should be held accountable if the charges are validated in court. Okay. Pena unsuccessfully ran as a candidate in the House District 14 seat in the South Valley against incumbent Representative Miguel Garcia in November. He lost by 3,600 votes, though. New Mexico, the timeline here, police originally said there were four shootings before announcing in January that a fifth attack happened at the former campaign office of a newly elected New Mexico Attorney General Raul Torres. In early December, Speaker of the New Mexico House, Javier Martinez, reported gunshots at his house. That was in early December. Albuquerque police said in early January that shootings began when Barboa's home was targeted on December 4th. 7 days later, there were more than a dozen shots fired at O'Malley's home. January 3rd, at least eight shots were fired at Senator Linda Lopez's home. 2 days later, on January 5th, three shots were fired at Senator Mo Macetas's home, offices, via the Albuquerque Police Department. We also now know that this crazed man showed up at people's houses prior to the shootings. Before the shootings, Pena visited the homes of his alleged targets to complain that the election he lost for state house was fraudulent. Pena came to my house right after the November election, said Brunello County Commissioner Adrian Barboa. She told NBC News, this is sort of erratic at the points he was trying to make about the election and about how many doors he knocked and how many votes, the number of votes didn't match. Now, I want to stop there. Now, when I have talked to candidates, Democrats of the day, I have talked about if you can knock every door in your district, you're going to have a decent chance at winning. It doesn't guarantee you're going to win. Nor is it if you knock on a door that that's an automatic vote. As a matter of fact, I've had numerous politicians talk about how they've had some unfortunate bad situations happen at doors. It does happen. This guy seems to have believed, and this is kind of a common mentality in politics, is that if you door knock, especially when it comes to state races or U.S. House races, maybe not statewide races, but, you know, your local state senator, your state assemblyman or whatever, the governor, county commissioner, if you knock on enough doors, basically you'll win. And that's kind of the mentality. This guy seems to have been convinced that if he just knocked on a door in a heavily Democratic district, by the way, that suddenly that vote is changed to him. Now, I live in Hopkins, which is a very solid blue D here. All right. The DFL controls this. Cheryl Youakim, Ron Latz. I'm a blessed man. That being said, I've had Republicans occasionally come knock on my door. They don't have a decent argument. they're flailing. It doesn't mean you're going to get that vote. It just means, especially when you're talking about districts where it's a little more of a toss-up, it has a potential. Pena came to the house after this and basically say he was frustrated because how many doors he knocked and how number of votes didn't match. Barboa, by the way, said she called the police after Pena's visit. He was at my door. He was aggressive. He was an election denier. He said on December 4th, 8 gunshots were fired at her home. Former County Commissioner Debbie O'Malley told NBC News that Pena also visited her home and was angry about losing the election. He felt the election was unfair and untrue, O'Malley said, adding that she later called the police on December 11th. Her home was struck by a dozen bullets. Pena previously served 7 years in prison for a 2008 smash-and-grab robbery. He's able to run for office after a judge ruled that laws barring convicted felons from office were unconstitutional. His Democratic opponent defeated him by 47 percentage point. Not exactly a squeaker there, but I made these points. First of all, this guy is a 20-time loser. And the fact that here's Republicans have got some real big problems. And I mean, it's in a lot of different ways. They have got problems. They're not winning over Generation Z at all. As a matter of fact, one of the things I've had an insider who studies Republican politics, not Michael Broadcorp, but another friend of mine who's a Republican, had mentioned to me that the thing that's scaring Republicans right now is that pretty much every other generation, millennials, you know, Generation X, boomers, that when they started coming to the voting age, there generally was a pretty consistent split in voters early on, a little less towards the Republicans at the younger ages, but they were making up for it later on. Generation Z is barely breaking for Republicans. Most of Generation Z is tired of our crap, and they're basically, and they show up to vote. And that's another thing that very much concerns them. They show up to vote. And as a matter of fact, this last election cycle, pretty much most of the baby boomers' impact where they've been able to control elections was wiped out by Generation Z, who showed up in force. Generation X shows up fairly well. Millennials, not so much, but it's not that they're not, it's not, you know, a massive drop off. How would I say it like that? But you see, this is why the Republicans have been able to have success, is they've got this baby boomer, you know, card up their sleeve where the baby boomers all show up, all vote. That was that. But now that buying power at elections is gone. And so they have a problem there, and their mentality seems to be to insult Generation Z. So good luck with that. You know, that's not going to fly. They, for some reason, well, they became enamored so much with rural America and the votes out there that they stopped running candidates in the cities. And this is to their detriment. And I've always been very, very admonishing of any political party, Democrats or Republicans, who do not run candidates, even in districts where you are not favored. I love Anita Gall. She ran out in a district for a Senate race where she was grossly outnumbered as far as Republicans versus Democrats, but she was a fantastic candidate and she ran out in that district. And God bless her. Absolutely. That's what you need to do. Republicans today, especially in a district where, oh, I don't know, there's a 47-point lead for the Democrats, will not even run it. So some crazed psychopath can come out there and say, I'll be the Republican candidate. And the Republicans are so desperate, as long as they say, hey, we're not going to give you any money, we're not going to give you any support, but we'll let you be the candidate if you want to. They don't do anything. The Republicans, for some reason, have stopped doing any kind of due diligence in regards to screening their candidates. And this guy, probably, considering he is a 20-time freaking loser, should have never been allowed to be on a Republican ticket, let alone twice, which is a big problem. But we also have to understand part of the Republicans' problem is that you definitely have this MAGA, QAnon, extremist far-right stuff is falling out of favor with a lot of people really fast. And their mentality seems to be screaming it louder and louder. Trump's legacy is enshrined. It's there. It's not going to go away. Trump is going to be forever remembered as the spoiled brat president who basically threw a temper tantrum when he got voted out of office. And no, he's got no chance on the freaking planet of getting reelected in 2024. He has no chance. And the Republicans even know this. That's why they're desperately hoping that his base, which is about 40 to 50% of the Republican Party at this point, maybe even go up to 60%, is still there. They still love him because they are the only thing that matters to those voters is owning the libs. Oh, that's it. And Trump will go out there and scream, loser. And they're like, yay, I'm so Christian, but he is just a horrible human being to them, and I love it. Trump is in trouble here. He does have some issues. President Trump's instructions led members of the crowd to attack the U.S. Capitol on January 6, according to a federal judge. In a ruling on Tuesday, U.S. District Court Judge Colleen Collar-Cotley found that Trump supporter Danian McAndrew was guilty on four counts related to January 6. After McAndrew read then-President Trump's announcement that he would hold the rally on January 6 that would be wild, she made plans to attend, excited to hear that President Trump speak and the protest against the 2020 presidential election. The judge continued, at the Stop the Steal rally, the then President Trump eponymously exhorted his supporters to, in fact, stop the steal by marching on the Capitol. Defendants marched to the Capitol where she testified she understood that only Congress had the power to fix the election outcome and that Congress was likely in session while she was around in the Capitol. The judge suggested the crowd had acted at the behest of Trump, having followed then-President Trump's instructions, which were in line with her stated desires. The court therefore finds the defendant intended her presence to be disruptive at the congressional business. Heeding the call of the former President Trump, she continued onwards to stop the steal, she concluded. For her participation in the insurrection of January 6th, the court finds McAndrew guilty. Yay. Good. Got to catch them all. Like Pokemon, got to catch them all. This guy is a loser who basically has been enabled by Trump and the Republicans and the nightly fringe fest that's on these news networks of the right, calling for, they're trying to kill you. They're trying to take your house. They want to take your kids. They want to do everything. Won't anyone stop them? And this is what happens. Don't think for one second that this guy wasn't influenced by this extremist far right. And today, the extremist far right is not even talking about Solomon Pena. They have no, who, what? If he's guilty, I guess so. And the reason why is he's been created. And right now, across this country, there's probably a few hundred of Solomon Penas out there just waiting for that straw to break. And then they go on their own shooting sprees. That's the scariest part of all. This is by design. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Wrap up the show for a Tuesday. It is the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. One final story here, and I meant to get this yesterday. I just didn't have the time. Two Minnesota farmers are accused of fraudulently selling more than $46 million in crops falsely touted as organic, said the U.S. Attorney's Office. James Clayton Wolf, 65, from Jeffers, is accused of defrauding grain purchases from 2014 to 2021 by selling non-GMO grains that were falsely labeled as organic. Wolf had previously been charged before a superseding indictment was announced this last week. The superseding indictment also charges 45-year-old Adam Clifford Olson of Jeffers in the case, alleging he assisted Wolf with sales after Wolf's certification was revoked in 2020. According to court documents, Wolf repeatedly purchased non-organic corn and soybeans from a grain seller and resold the grain as an organic product. He also alleged to have had grown conventionally farmed crops using chemical fertilizers and pesticides, which is in violation of organic farming standards. Initially, the investigation didn't include the name or name Olson, but referred to him as an associate who further helped with the fraudulent sales. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, organic farming uses non-GMO seeds and crops that are grown without chemicals or fertilizers that generate its higher prices at market than non-organic crops. The U.S. attorney said the superseding indictment charges Wolf and Olson with three counts of wire fraud, one count of conspiracy. Wolf made his first initial appearance July 2022. Olson will make his first appearance January 26, 2023. The fraud is felony punishable up to 20 years in prison. And I have no problem about that. Jeffers is, oh gosh, it's out there. It's basically on the way out towards Pipestown, kind of south and west of Sleepy Eye, north of Windham. So that's where you're kind of looking at it, and kind of by the Ingalls Wilder home at Walnut Grove, by that way. You got to throw the book at these guys. Now, I get it. There are probably some conservatives out there who are like, get them, get those people that want organic stuff, get those liberal hippies. But I can tell you right now, there's a lot of farmers that are out there who are livid about this because they follow the rules. And as they said, this is a premium product. It gets you a higher amount of money. And this is no different in my mind than when a corporate executive, you know, screws over their own customers at like a bank so that they can increase fines and penalties and jam more money into their pocket. That it's the same thing to me. And it really is disturbing to see this level of repeated, I mean, once again, this guy has been doing this for years, repeated crime, because he basically just, he didn't think it was anything to rob someone of what they thought was organic. You got to throw these guys in the book at these guys. You got to put these guys in jail. Or else you're only asking for other people, because I guarantee these people are looking. It's like, well, wait a minute here. How'd they get away with it over and over and over and over again? Maybe I should do that. Now, once again, I have zero doubt there are some people out in conservative country who are like, get those liberals. But I can tell you right now, there's a lot of farmers who do it right, who spend the extra time, extra money, work as hard as they can to make an organic product. They're not happy with this guy either. They are not. So, good catch. Chuck them in jail. Let's be done with them. Yeah. And maybe we just, maybe we make sure we serve them some organic food. Just to maybe see if they might like that. Maybe they will. Native Roots Radio, I am awake. 6 o'clock hour tonight. Stick around for that. Hey, have a good one. We are back on a Wednesday. Till then, see ya.